This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. Truly amazing. This is the most people that have ever been in Slot Foundation. It's a great honor for us. After the conversation, which will be about 45 minutes, there's a microphone to my left. A few individuals are welcome to come up, line in the aisle, and to pose those questions to Karen and to Werner. My name's Aaron Levy. I'm the executive director here and a senior curator at Slot Foundation. On behalf of my colleagues Jean-Michel Rabaté and Oswaldo Romberg, it's with great pleasure that I welcome everyone here tonight to Slot Foundation on the occasion of Werner Herzog's visit to the University of Pennsylvania at the invitation of the Cinema Studies program. I'm particularly honored to recognize the presence here tonight of Rebecca Bushnell, Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania, as well as Ann Matter, Associate Dean. We are truly grateful to both of you for your support of this program. Tonight's conversation culminates a week-long series of events that have been made possible through the generous support of the Jerry and Emily Spiegel Funds in Fine Arts at the University of Pennsylvania. We would also like to acknowledge the collaboration and support of Julie Schneider, who's here tonight, and the Department of Fine Arts, Paul Geyer, Simon Richter, and the Department of German, as well as the Department of English, International House of Philadelphia, the Society of Friends of Slot Foundation, and Susie Slayson and the Roy Anita Titus Foundation. Very special thanks for organizing Werner Herzog's visit also goes to Paul Holdengraber and Nathaniel Kahn, both of whom are also with us tonight, as well as Timothy Corrigan, Karen Beckman, and of course Nicola Gentili at the Cinema Studies program. I'm particularly grateful to Nicola, Associate Director of the program, and a dear colleague and friend of many years, with whom I've had the pleasure to work towards this special evening and to learn from. Before turning the proceedings over to Timothy, who will introduce Werner Herzog and Karen, I'd like to just say that Herzog's work resonates with our activities at Slot Foundation, as well as its very essence, and it is thus a great honor to welcome him here in what feels to my colleagues and I like the culmination of our first 5 years of activity. Herzog has often expressed his delight in the pleasures of reading, as he did last night, but also his profound concerns about the tendency in academia, and arguably in contemporary art as well, towards a culture of isolation that moves away from an intimate and intense engagement with the world. It is part of our mission here at Slot to challenge this tendency and to start a dialogue and open a space for conversation in Philadelphia with the many communities that make the city such a wonderful place in which to live and experiment. The diversity of our events and our exhibitions is hopefully representative of that effort. It is thus an enormous honor, the greatest honor, to have Werner Herzog here with us, participating here tonight in this event. Tonight's event also serves as the opening for a modest exhibit that Tim and I have organized in the front gallery, which explores how the concept of the documentary functions in Herzog's films, as well as his conceptions of ecstatic truth, fabrication, and the metaphysics of filmmaking. I encourage all of you to return here in the coming days and weeks when it's less intimate and less crowded to have a more intimate experience with those films and the photographs of the Basel-based photographer Beat Presser, including this wonderful and memorable image that you see when you come in on your right from Ghana during the filming of Cobra Verde. I encourage you to also visit our website where you can listen and download an audio recording of the conversation we had about Werner's work on Monday. Tonight's event will also be made available in that same manner in the days ahead online. Last but not least, I'd like to extend a personal moment, a personal thanks to the students, my students in the RBSL Bergman Foundation Curatorial Seminar here at the university for helping to install the installation. And now I'd like to turn it over to Timothy Corrigan, Professor of English and formerly Director of Cinema Studies, to introduce our honored conversants. Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. I'll be very brief here. I'm both ecstatic and apologetic about these enormous crowds we've been getting the last two nights. Ecstatic, or I should say apologetic, because, of course, a lot of people have been unable to get in. Ecstatic, because, and that is the word of the week, I think, ecstatic, because this is, in some ways, a culminating moment for Penn Cinema Studies, which I'm representing as former director of Cinema Studies. We've been working for 4 or 5 years now, not just to establish a very rigorous academic program, but I think more broadly to create a film culture in West Philadelphia that reaches out to the whole city as well, which is part of a larger, I think, education that brings filmmakers, scholars, producers, and anyone involved in film and media as part of this really important and growing part of what our culture is about. And seeing these crowds is just a sort of a magnificent reward and, I think, testimony to what we've been able to achieve. It's been an achievement that has been responsible to many other people in this program, some of whom have been mentioned here. My immediate colleagues, most famously Nicola Gentili, but also my other academic colleagues as well, Peter DeCherny, Meta Mazai, and Karen Beckman, who will be the new director of Cinema Studies and who will be directing this conversation tonight. I also want to thank Rebecca Bushnell and Ann Matter for the incredible support of the college along the way, and encourage you to stay in touch with us as we move forward in the years ahead to make Penn and West Philadelphia a real center for what film is about in the world, I think. Many of you know the work of Karen, both in the classroom and outside. She has published two very important works, one called Vanishing Women, which is on magic, film, and feminism, and a new book called Still Moving, on photography and cinema, which is coming out soon, along with numerous other projects that she's been involved with. I feel awkward even trying to introduce Werner Herzog, because anyone who is in this room knows who Werner Herzog is. I myself got involved in film studies in the 70s when I discovered Werner Herzog's films when they first came to America. And what's most remarkable about him for me is that over the 40 years since then, he's remained consistently important, consistently original, and consistently reinventing what filmmaking is about. It's a great honor, great pleasure to welcome him tonight. Thank you.
So let's begin. Yeah. I'd like to add my thanks to you for your generosity today with our students. I know you've been talking all day with people, so thank you for that.
Yeah. May I suggest that we stand up?
Yeah, sure, so that people can see.
Us. Yeah.
Yeah. So our task today is a simple one. We have to get to the heart of ecstatic truth in 45 minutes. And my sense from your films is that that's not something that you, truth does not reveal itself directly, but this is something that you move in and around. So I wanted to start with a question that was inspired by something in the film that we showed on Tuesday night, Encounters at the End of the World. You mentioned the possibility that after the demise of the human species, alien archaeologists may come to the Earth. And I want to ask you, if those alien archaeologists do come and all they find are the films of Werner Herzog, what is it that you hope that they will learn about the human species from your films?
I don't know, but and of course, aliens landing on our planet, of course, is a figment of our fantasies.
Right.
It's something born out of Star Wars and a collective sort of cultural figure of imagination. Aliens will not reach us; they're just too far away, and we are too far away from the next star out there. Outside of our solar system, it's simply too far. It sounds quite close, but Alpha Centauri is 4.5 light years away, and at the highest velocity that we have ever achieved It would take you about 700,000-800,000 years to get there. So how do you do that? And you cannot, you will not be able to reach even a small, tiny fraction of the speed of light. And no matter what you try to tell me, it will not persuade you. It's not going to happen because reaching the speed of light would mean burning the entire matter in order to gain kinetic energy and propel us to higher velocities. And you cannot accelerate a human being to, let's say, 10% of the speed of light. We would be crushed immediately.
But aliens.
Aliens would be crushed as well. They will not be able to achieve that end, as my real science fiction, only real science fiction film, The Wild Blue Yonder shows. They are not these superhuman creatures that can destroy this planet in 5 seconds flat. They all suck. they are just a failure. They achieve nothing, and they're kind of deceived and kind of desperately lost on our planet. I think if alien astronauts, and again as a figure of as a figment of our imagination, if they ever land, they would probably flee as quickly as they can.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
So, from the statistics that you've just given us, it's clear that you have an interest, and from your films too, you have an interest in flight and the flight of the imagination outside of the Earth.
Yes.
And you seem to be drawn to characters who are compelled to fly in spite of their human condition. And it seems like your camera seems compelled to fly too, and that you use aerial shots a lot. And so part of one question I would like to ask you is, why, you know, what is it about these characters who yearn to fly that draws you so, you know, repeatedly to this kind of character? Mm. And what is it that you think aerial shots in particular can show us about the Earth? Because it seems that if we're looking for moments of ecstatic truth in your films, yeah, that ecstatic truth often comes from above.
Not necessarily that I have to have a bird's eye perspective.
Right.
So,
right.
And it's quite a few questions that you pack together,
yeah,
right now. So I try
take
to
one.
No, I'll try to sort it out and do it one after the other. Uh-huh. Yes, sure. I would love to be able to fly, and I'm one of these persons who has these dreams of being able to fly. And the motive of flight and of the need to fly appears quite many times in my movies. Little Dieter needs to fly is some sort of a paradigmatic sort of title. Yes, there is a man who needs to fly. But yet, like in an ancient Greek drama, and my assistant director, collaborator, and friend Herb Golder, who is a professor at Boston University for the classics, he explains to me, Werner, that you are doing a film exactly like the ancient Greek drama. Uh-huh. You have a man and his dream and punishment for the dream, and at the end some sort of redemption. Herb Golder's parents are actually here.
Oh, yeah?
I salute them. Uh-huh. I've seen them for the first time in my life, and I'm very proud to have you here.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, there's a great wish of in me to leave the, of course, the confines of who I am, to be able to fly. Physically, I tried it. Yes, my dream as a kid, and I grew up in the Bavarian mountains, and I literally grew up on skis. And for us kids, there was only one dream: we would fly. We would become ski jumpers. And my best friend wanted to become a German national champion.
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, that's not what I'm into. I want to become world champion of ski flying. And we were fiercely competing. And my career as somebody flying and going into this complete solitude and ecstasy of being airborne, uh-huh, without really an instrument to fly, but right, just as a human being to fly. That ended, unfortunately, very, very abruptly from 1 second to the next, when my best friend had a near-fatal accident on the ramp, and we were all alone out there in training. And it was so horrifying that from that moment on, I could never get close to a ramp anymore. So it just ended.
Uh-huh.
It just ended this dream. And in a way, there is flight in my imagination. There's flight that is something beyond our physicality, something which is not in our bodies. And in a way, the great ecstasy of the sculptor Steiner, the ski flying 2 times world champion, became some sort of an embodiment of my own dreams. Uh-huh. Somebody who physically does and steps outside of me and materializes in someone else whom I love very dearly, because he flew.
Yeah.
And he flew instead of me, and of course I had to do a film on him.
Yeah.
And this motif returns quite often. And in a way, you have distant relatives to those who try to fly. Ultimately, it is, how shall I say, defiance of gravity. And a film like Fitzcarraldo, where I move a 360-ton ship over a mountain, is defiance of gravity. It has to do with similar sort of dreams of leaving the physical body shape of a ship somehow behind, and the ship goes over the mountain.
Yeah, and one of the things I love about your images of flight and leaving the earth is that it's not just pure transcendence, it's also about the effort that humans put into that urge and that need to defy gravity, that there seems to be that pull of gravity and that experience of falling, or you called it tumbling yesterday, that is as much a part of your films as the ecstatic flight. Would that?
Yeah. In a way, yes, of course we are prone to crash, and we are prone to come down. My wife, who is afraid of planes when they bounce badly in turbulences, she asked me, and she still holds it against me. She asked me, what's going to happen? And I said, well, in a way, don't worry, in a way or another, the plane will come down.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes, it will come down, and that's the only answer you can give. It's not a very husbandly answer, I have to admit, but...
I think it is.
But it's the way I would say things. But of course, we do see the downfall and the danger and the fear of falling. People have it in their dreams. Unfortunately, I do not dream at night, so I have no experience of that. But people apparently dream of falling, uh-huh, and they speak about it. And analysts speak about whom we shouldn't mention at all in a discourse like this, because they've done...
It's off my list.
they've done too much bad and hasn't helped anyone anywhere. So, and it's a misconception of the 20th century. I wanted to mention it yesterday in the discourse with Paul Holdengräber, more furiously address that. So let's skip that.
Okay.
But the kind of... There's a deep fear, not only of physical falling or the notion of falling in dreams that others apparently have. It's also the fear of the tragedy of coming down. A whole house of Atreus is coming down, and generation after generation is somehow doomed, and the downfall is settled for the ancient Greeks by the gods, but in our case by other forces. And there is a sense of tragedy which is within all of us in a way.
Uh-huh.
And a film that addresses it, a subject of a film which in a way addresses it, in, I believe, has to do with things that go on inside, deep inside of our hearts. Mm-hmm. What else did you ask about flying and falling? And
well, I think that we can ask another question.
Yes, I may have forgotten part of your question.
I don't think so. Yeah. So another thing that I wanted to ask you about is the frequent comments that you've made about our impoverished imaginations and our lack of images that function and that are rich. And in one of your interviews, you particularly lambast television as a medium that you say, you know, our grandchildren will blame us for not throwing hand grenades in the television stations because of our exposure of them to advertisements. And you talk about it as the biggest danger, along with different kinds of war. And yet you've also worked in television.
No, I have not really worked in television, but sometimes television has shown my stuff, but I'm always aiming for theaters.
That's what I wanted to ask you. What do you see the difference? Partly I want to ask you to say more about television, and then I'd like you to talk about the difference between television and cinema.
I have to do it step by step again. Yes, you asked about the endangerment by images through mass media like television or by magazines. I don't have to elaborate much. Just turn on your TV setting. Right. You know what I'm talking about. So that has to be taken with caution. But there's other endangerments of it's manifold, and some of it is a sense of reality and sense for the world out there has been challenged by virtual realities, and it's not just television, it's the internet, it's digital effects, it's Photoshop, and in what can we trust.
It's also certain kinds of cinema?
No, I wouldn't compare it to cinema. It's actually something that tries to encroach into our sense of dignified and new and exciting images, which we should defend. And it comes from there, and then it comes from all sorts of sides, including from academia. But that's a minor event. It's just a minor event,
not
which
for me.
Can. Yeah. No, yeah. I mean. And I do not mean academia per se. I mean efforts by academia to overanalyze, vivisect poetry, literature, cinema. You just name it. The only form of art that is still resistant and cannot be tackled by it is music. Mm-hmm. You cannot speak in post-structural, post-modernist, post-whatever terms about music like that. However, when you start to create some climate in some sort, in some niches of academia, in over-theoreticizing things and just trying to only find textures, nothing else but structures, as if the structures, and of course structures of social behavior, structures inherent in history, structures inherent in psychology and whatever, to impose it on and enforce it on literature, for example. It doesn't do any good to any piece of literature. It does not do good anything to movies. Just try to get away from it. That's my advice. Because the real wonder about cinema gets lost. The great love for poetry can be trampled, this flame that's somewhere there, you can trample it out and extinguish it easily. And that's a danger, and I like literature or films or music as something that can give you consolation. The post-structuralists will never accept a term like consolation, and yet it is there, or the kind of collective agitation of mind, and with Paul Holdengräber, we have discussed it very early, because he's one of those agitators. the agitator of dialogue, the agitator of collective agitation of mind, and that is something much more needed. Or tonight, I thought about my wife, who grew up in Siberia in a dictatorship, and many books were forbidden. And she, as a 15-year-old, hand copies a secret copy of Bulgakov's Master and Margarita, the entire text secretly in longhand, and the schoolgirls would circulate these things around. Uh-huh. And that's what we need. And that's what real agitation, that is real reception of literature. Uh-huh. The post-structuralists will stamp them out. And we should be very, very cautious. So
yesterday also in your conversation you were very critical of academia, and I think the things that you express I certainly care about a lot, because it's the nightmare of our own lives that we might be betraying the spirit of the thing that we care about. And
as long as your students love literature, right. And as long as you guide them in loving cinema.
So you do believe that part of what I wanted to ask you was that because it seems like you, when it comes to scientific knowledge, you pursue in your films the route that academic scientific people take, and I'm interested in knowing whether you think that the arts, that the university can do something to help nurture the reinvigoration of our images, or whether you think that the structure of the university makes that very difficult to do for the arts.
We should not speak summarily about university or academia, because when you are a mathematician or you are in... let's say you are in law school or you are in medical school. Mm-hmm. Yes, sure, there has to be academic training. There has, even though some of the most interesting elements come in through people who come from a very different angle of thinking,
yeah.
And sometimes the very unusual ones, the mavericks, come up with something astonishing. And they shouldn't be overlooked, but I have nothing against academia, I have nothing against universities. Right. Thanks God they exist. However, in humanities, that's where it gets tricky.
Right.
And that's where I'm always alarmed, and more alarmed than a few years ago. It's very alarming what is going on. I do not have a clear remedy, but... what I think is, and I hated school. I hated school so bad, and in particular German literature. We were vivisecting Goethe's Faust for almost a year, and it was so bad. And it's on a more primitive level than in academia. It's on a stupid primitive level. It was so unbearable that as until today. I have not been capable to read Goethe's Faust. Uh-huh. They tried to stamp it. Even in school, when I was only 17, they tried to stamp out and trample on my sense of poetry and sense of literature. And thanks God I survived it. And I had very, very serious plans. I mean, practically serious plans to burn the school to the ground. I'm not one of those Columbine type kids who opens fire. No, I would have done it at 3 at night when nobody would be close to the to the building. But and this kind of aversion and this kind of despair about school system and academic system I still carry in me, and it would be silly to just rant against it without an argument, but I think the simplest, most easy argument is how does academia manage to create enthusiasm for literature, for poetry, And much of what is happening in literature, for example, I don't know how English literature is taught here or how film is taught here, I do not know. But how does it maintain, how would you maintain the kind of love and enthusiasm for cinema?
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your coming into the space of the university to talk with us, you know, partly about this, because I think it's very helpful.
No, I don't have a recipe. I cannot be helpful because I cannot tell you how to teach the course. How do you manage to instill a sense of love for poetry?
But criticism is helpful, you know, and I'll be writing my lectures with your words in my ear. Anyway, so part of the question that I asked you we began with the impoverishment of images and television. But I'd like you to say something about how you understand the difference between cinema and television. And also, you know, especially because you've just released a lot of your films on DVD, your documentary and shorts set of DVDs has just come out. And so I'm wondering how you feel people will experience your films differently if they're watching it at home, on their own or with a couple of people on a television screen, or if they're watching it in the cinema, and how you feel about
it,
that?
It is, everything is shifting at the moment. There are serious people in the distribution industry who predict that DVDs will disappear very soon. Mm-hmm. In maybe 10 years from now, we won't have it anymore.
Right.
It can happen, yes, and I see the reasons behind it. Let's not go too far into this. Television, I think we all had... Early on, in the earlier times, we had hopes that television would become an instrument of education, instrument of culture, mm-hmm. and of course it has not. I do remember when the second German channel, ZDF, was inaugurated in the 60s. There were people who would deliver speeches. And part of the very first moment of ZDF, the second channel of nationwide television, was they read the prologue of Goethe's Faust. and in a way that hinted to, yes, we have created an instrument that will elevate the collective awareness for great culture into the general population. It did not.
Uh-huh.
It just did not. It turned exactly the other way around, and now it has become exactly the common denominator, the most common lowest denominator.
Uh-huh.
However, television has great advantages in certain ways. You do get a sense what, for example, the collective preparedness, what the collective expectations, what the collective dreams are all about. What is the dreams of every trucker here in the United States? Answer is Dolly Parton. So you have to study Dolly Parton, and you have to study WrestleMania, and I keep saying, and Nicole Smith. Yes, because there's something momentous about these events. Momentous in a way that, and it's very easy that to dismiss television. The poet must not avert his eyes. That's my maxim, and I'm saying that. And keep watching things. Not that you have to watch television all the time.
Right.
And of course, it has grave disadvantages. The biggest disadvantage in television nowadays is that it's completely market driven. It's the sponsors, the companies who finance television. But I do not blame Coca-Cola or Nike or so for destroying the flow of narrative. The flow of narrative is something we have seen for tens of thousands of years, of cavemen sitting at the campfire and telling stories.
Yeah.
And it's tens of thousands of years, and it's 3,000-4,000 years of high culture, of literature, of novels, of narration in written form, and it's now it is somehow disrupted the flow of narration, a gift, a human gift that distinguishes us from cows and from the goose, that I would rather roast in the oven. Uh-huh. It distinguishes me. The goose cannot roast me, but I can roast the goose. So there are clear distinctions. And the clearest distinction is that the goose cannot tell a story. It's such a wonderful gift that we have. And here comes a time of consumerism and of capitalism and our way of life, which destroys a fundamental achievement of the human race. And this is one of the reasons why I do not work in doing commercials. Uh-huh. Yes, I could earn money in doing commercials, and I could pay the rent. I do not do it. It's right. A question, a little bit a question of principle. I don't want to make a big moral issue out of it. It's not so much a moral issue. It's a question of how do we preserve sense of storytelling. Uh-huh. So let's not talk about TV anymore. Let's talk about DVDs now.
Okay.
Yes, DVD is a form, of course, technically much better than videos, mm-hmm. and I like it for that. And it's all shifting. You can you have an accessibility of films, for example. You can buy them then, like the collected works of Turgenev, uh-huh. the collected works of Spencer, the collected works of Hemingway or so. And you have it accessible in a way, whether it's in form of a DVD or ultimately in digital files on your cell phone. You may download through your cell phone an entire movie, go to a friend's house, and beam it to the flat screen, which will be much larger than these screens. Uh-huh. And the technical quality will create something, a technical equivalent to cinema. We will see that. Uh-huh. Privately accessible at all times. However, we will probably not have the collective experience of seeing a film. And this is something very important, and I'm insisting on cinema, and therefore I have difficulties to accept, yes, I'm working for television. No, I want to work for the screen and for a collective experience. Right. Sometimes, yes, a television station paid most of the money, and I knew it would end up on TV as well. But I always keep the cinema rights for myself whenever I can. And I keep this alive.
Yeah.
We will see new forms of God knows. I don't believe that kids will watch an entire movie on their cell phone. I don't see that. But as an instrument to store it, to beam it down from somewhere or connect it through your cable and collect it as a digital file. Yes, that will come fairly soon.
Uh-huh. Do you see cinema as a place where we do collective dreaming?
Of course, that's a place where we do that together. The collective dreams of the world are created in a way in movie theaters.
Yeah.
And not when you are sitting lonesome in front of a TV set. You can't even laugh. Even if a film is very funny, you never laugh when you're all alone. And this is why TV stations in some of these sitcoms and other funny movies add laughter from the tape.
Nobody can laugh on their own.
Yeah, to somehow cheat you out from the solitude of being alone and nobody laughs, but you hear the laughter. And so you feel better.
I wanted to ask you about comedy, because I was struck in Encounters at the End of the World by the roar of laughter that went up when the image of the chimpanzee riding the goat appeared on screen that seemed like a one-liner joke. And I'm interested in your relationship to comedy and whether you think... because I think there's always comic aspects in your film.
Yeah, a lot of humor, let's put it this way. I'm not into comedies, but many of my films have a lot of humor in it.
Yeah. Is it becoming more explicit, do you think?
In some of the films, uh-huh. yes. When you look at The Wild Blue Yonder, yes, it's very hilarious. Yeah. There's a lot of humor. And when you see Brad Dourif as an alien, you know, yes, he's the only authentic alien that we can muster here. Uh-huh. And he's wonderful, and it's very funny. However, I know, and you only experience a laughter when you have a house with at least 100 people in it. If it's only three people spread out in a theater, it is not a collective experience anymore. Yeah. And I make my mistakes. And Billy Wilder was wonderful to understand how, for example, in Some Like It Hot, I think John Lemon, or what is his name?
Jack
uh-huh. Lemon in female dress is on the towards the end of the film dreams about marriage, and Tony Curtis asks him, yeah, what, why you are, but you are a man and marriage, and so what does it give you? And he says security. and now what Billy Wilder does, and he's very very smart about it, he knows the audiences will roar in laughter, and until the next line is said, he needs at least 6, 7, 8, 10 seconds until he can go into the next line. That's why he gave him two marimbas. And he says security, and he's shaking the marimbas and dreaming about the girl who has security. And then comes the next line of dialogue. And for example, in a very funny, humorous moment in Encounters at the End of the World, and I make this mistake. Polish scientist discovers on one single day three new species of a single cell creature. Uh-huh. And they talk a little bit about it, two scientists, and then from off I'm saying, is this a great moment? Everybody laughs. Yes, you don't ask such a thing. Everybody laughs. The answer comes almost immediately. I'm asking, is this a great moment? And the scientist says, yeah. So, and nobody hears it because everybody's still laughing. Yeah. So my abilities to read an audience correctly, as some great masters of comedies like Billy Wilder have done, I don't have it in me. Yes, I can create a situation that is full of humor, but I do not read
the comic timing.
The timing of it, yes, I make my mistakes.
Uh-huh. Huh. When you talked about Fred Astaire yesterday, and you said that that you loved him in spite of himself because of his relationship to space and the movement of his body.
Yeah, how he moves and how he dances. It's just phenomenal.
I wondered whether you like slapstick comedy, and whether that early moment of cinema where it's so physical and so much about the movement of the body, whether that interests you, or whether there's something
It does, yes, but I have my only and lonesome favorite is Buster Keaton. I never got that much intrigued about Harold Lloyd or Charlie Chaplin. It's Buster Keaton, the kind of solitude of the man, and the kind of stoic endurance of the quirks of fate and of the objects around that are all an impediment to a human being.
He belongs in your cast of characters.
Yeah, and he's a wonderful, wonderful, deep sort of figure, and I truly love the man. Uh-huh. But it's not that I'm such a great fan of these early slapstick movies, even though they are very movie, and this jerky movement and running and police chases has never impressed me that much. In Fred Astaire, it's something else, because it's so absolutely and crazily stylized. It's so remote from the real world as it can get. Uh-huh. And for only $10, you can remove yourself from reality as far as you can even imagine. Uh-huh. And you just better watch a Fred Astaire movie.
Yeah.
And him singing Don't Monkey with Broadway. And the way they are dancing, it's just phenomenal. And the face of Fred Astaire is so enormously stupid. I've never seen a face that projects stupidity in such a bold way as he does. And yet lines of dialogue in the song that they are singing, so phenomenally stupid, and still I love it. I don't know why, but there's something very, very dear to my heart
Yeah.
When I even think about Fred Astaire, I become mellow.
Oh, good. Well, on a more serious note,
yeah.
One of the things that critics sometimes say about you, they describe you as partly because of this desire to transcend, or is that they describe you as a neo-romantic and talk about the mysticism of your films and the spirituality of your films. And mm-hmm. It seems to me the way that I understand these aspects of your films is I always find them to be in tension with your what seems to be an equal fascination with the banal, so that you get the, in Encounters at the End of the World, you get the iceberg and the scale of the iceberg and the sense of a cathedral from under the water, but you also get the catastrophe of the Mr. Frosty machine breaking in the South Pole, and that these things coexist in the space of your films. But I wonder, and that, I think, doesn't undercut the sense
let's
of...
Let us not extend the question too far. Right. I keep losing you otherwise.
But can you talk about your relationship, the spiritual aspect of your cinema, and maybe the role that music plays in that, and how you ground that?
Again, let's try to contain it a little bit. Yeah, but I have to say, terms like mysticism or spirituality of my films and all these things, I can only touch it with a pair of pliers.
Right.
And romanticism, well, that's always the disease of reviewers of my films, because normally reviewers do not know much about Germany. They know about the Nazis and they know about the romantics.
Yeah. In so they have to say it.
So it's or maybe sometimes expressionism and Bertolt Brecht or so, and then they all of a sudden comes up with a crazy idea that there's a Brechtian principle in my films. So it leaves me kind of baffled. But romanticism is an important aspect of what does not constitute my cinema. It does not, the most, when I speak in Les Blancs' film, Burden of Dreams, about nature and about the vileness and baseness and obscenity of nature, you cannot get a more contrary position towards a romantic view of nature than I will give you. Or in Grizzly Man, the kind of romanticizing, sentimentalizing of wild nature through Timothy Treadwell does not go uncontested for one moment.
Right.
I raise my voice and I have an ongoing argument with him. Here I differ with Treadwell, my voice says.
Right.
And I'm saying things that are the utter diametrically distant positions against romanticism. So I'm not really into it. And my real connections to this, with one single exception, and that is Caspar David Friedrich, the painter. But I like his way he saw landscapes. Landscapes as an inner image of a human quality. The jungle in Aguirre, it's not a romantic jungle, but the jungle in Aguirre as a fever dream, the fever dream of some crazed men out there in the jungle in search of El Dorado.
Yeah.
Yes, there's one small affinity, but otherwise my affinities go much, much earlier, much later, like, for example, Martin Luther, and I'm speaking of his Bible translation, the language of his Bible translation, which is very, very deeply embedded in my sense of literature. Poets like Hölderlin, who was at the time of the Romantics, and he's not a Romantic poet. Kleist, who wrote some wonderful short stories and some dramas, not a Romantic, all at the time of Romantic poetry. Büchner, who wrote Lenz. If there's anyone here in the German department, force your students to learn it by heart. It's only 35 pages of prose text, but nothing more intense and nothing more beautiful in my knowledge within the German language. Such a wonderful and fine prose, and not a romantic.
Yeah.
And in literature, it would be, let's say, English literature, some of them fairly early, some of them like, is Hemingway a romantic? No. Is Joseph Conrad a romantic? No. Is Bruce Chatwin? No. So my affinities, my proclivities are totally different. Uh-huh. My aims are different. My sources of inspiration are different in literature. And of course, much of it goes back to antiquity. I have started to go back to read texts of that I was supposed to read in school. Now I read them, Latin, ancient Greek authors.
Uh-huh.
And for the sake, mostly, yes, sometimes for the wonder of the language and the wonder of the poetry they have in them, and sometimes for nothing but sheer consolation. In moments of deepest travail and tribulation, I have and I find consolation by reading the Book of Job in Luther's translation,
uh-huh.
and by reading Livy's Livy's Second Punic War. That's it's only for the sake of consolation. And literature can do that, and music can do that as well.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, religion, but I'm not into religion anymore.
Right. So I think I'll just ask a couple more questions, and then
yeah.
we'll open it up. But we were talking today at lunch about the manly man. And I wanted to ask you about that, because it seems to me that in your work, this figure of the hero and a certain kind of masculinity that's totally different from the Hollywood hero is very important.
Correct, yeah.
And is very important to your sense of what you call real adventure.
Yeah.
And you say that this real adventure has been lost, like the real
in
meaning
way,
of
yes.
it.
Yes, we came to this conversation at lunch because I somehow got immediately alerted by the beautiful fact that you married an athlete, a boxer.
That's right.
Yeah. And I said, yes, fine. This makes a lot of sense. Yes, beautiful, wonderful, yes. And we talked about...
I think so.
Yes, we do not... even though I do not know your husband, I congratulate you. Ah, here he is, my salute to you, yes. And yes, but it's and immediately some other ladies at the table started to talk about manliness, and so I'm not a feminist and I'm not a macho either, but there is, and we talked about what is a prevalent image, the masculine image in Hollywood, in the more collective mainstream concepts of audiences, and it is more the post-pubescent kid boys, Leonardo DiCaprio, who looks like a pubescent boy even though he's probably 30 by now, or Brad Pitt, or you just name it, almost everyone. And the only last manly man out there is Clint Eastwood. But he comes from a stock of men that was Humphrey Bogart and Gary Cooper and John Wayne and Charles Bronson, and you just name it. They were Richard Widmark. So they are out of fashion. So probably the female dreams, collective dreams, have significantly shifted. And that's a very, very interesting thing. Ultimately, I do not want to see these post-pubescent boy men all the time in movies. It doesn't feel right, and it will shift. Hopefully, it will shift again to the more manly men. And it's very difficult for me, for example, to cast a new film that I'm planning. There has to be a manly man who, at the same time, is kind of fragile as well. That's the hardest to find.
Yeah.
and really difficult to cast it.
And that's the difference between the... It's one of the differences between the kind of stereotypical manly man of Hollywood, like the kind of hero,
No, it's not. John Wayne was probably just straightforward, a center forward in a football team, and he comes with the shoulder pads at you, and he comes at full gallop. That's the simplified form of it. But a manly man like Humphrey Bogart, a man of complexity. A man like Marlon Brando, yes, a very manly man, and yet full of complexity. And of course, it has shifted significantly, and it's interesting to observe what is emerging and what may be coming up next. I keep wondering about it.
And you speak of the collective dreams of women perhaps shifting, but at times in your films you've looked very closely at female characters like Fini Straubinger.
Yes.
But the attention of your filmmaking has been much more on the on male characters, and I wanted to maybe end by asking you why it is that you think you've so infrequently focused on female characters, and whether you think in your films going forward that then, you know, is that something you've deliberately shied away from, or just has
I have
stories?
No real clear answer to that. Uh-huh. I don't know. Uh-huh. But when you speak about male characters, they are complicated ones, and not the machos. When you look at Bruno S. in Kaspar Hauser or Stroszek, no, they're not that sort of John Wayne types, right. Nor is Kinski, nor is Christian Bale in Rescue Dawn.
Yeah, you've given us a whole new vocabulary of masculinity, I think, in your films.
Well,
a
I have not
range,
thought about it, but it's nice that you say that, because I wouldn't make a series of films self-perpetuation of some machismo or whatever. No, I'm not into that. But there is a certain manliness in some of them, yes, sure. And a woman would not dream about hoisting a ship over a mountain in the Amazonian jungle. Women do not have that kind of dream. It's a fever dream of men. And these fever dreams are very, very known to me. I feel familiar with it. I feel comfortable with it, and I do the stories that I do understand. So it's fairly simple and fairly complicated, because I'm not looking at myself, and I don't want to analyze what I've done. So I'm kind of cautious, but your observation is right, undeniably. And in a way, I believe that Ingmar Bergman wouldn't be able to answer you why in almost all his films women are the leading, the central characters, with a few exceptions. Yes, Wild Strawberries is an old man, and very few others where you have the protagonist a male.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can't really answer it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm going to open this up now for questions, and we have a... Aaron, are you going to explain the procedure?
There's so many people here tonight. There's over 350 at this point. There's a microphone to my left where Nicola Gentili is standing. If you could raise your hand, I know that everybody can't ask a question, but we'll bring you over to the microphone, and we'll try to allow enough of you to ask questions.
Okay. Yes.
Do you want to
see? No, I remain standing. It's better.
Can those of you that have questions just raise your hand, and I'll just point to five of you at a time. Yeah, the one in the back, in the red shirt, right there in the aisle.
Yesterday you spoke highly of walking.
Yes.
I was wondering what your thoughts on bicycle riding.
On?
Bicycle riding.
Bicycles.
I think nothing is comparable to walking on foot, but we should not speak about those who are recreationally walking or sauntering like Thoreau. I just got a short essay. He writes about walking, but he's sauntering out into the woods, and he comes back to his cottage in the evening, and he thinks and he's musing about nature and all sorts of things. Not that I mean seriously traveling on foot, and not backpacking or so, where you have your tent and your sleeping bag, just walking like I'm right now, and I would walk from here to the Rocky Mountains. So that would be a serious sort of walk. I would do it for a serious reason. Bicycling is always some sort of an instrument, and you are, in a way, you are tied to a path that you are using for the bicycle. Of course, there's this crazy fashion about mountain biking, which I think is kind of stupid to do that. But bicycling, yes, you experience much more of the world around you when you are on a bicycle. But it doesn't come close to what you are doing when you are traveling on foot. And when you are riding a bicycle, let's say a very long distance, you would normally have a tendency to have your tent and sleeping bag and cooking utensils in your saddlebags. That's a very, very different way of traveling. If you are talking about traveling with a donkey or traveling with a horse, take a horse and travel to Mexico City with it. That's something different. Yes, I would prefer you traveling, if you consider it seriously, travel on a donkey or on a horse. Yes.
Hi, Warner. Thanks for coming to Philadelphia. Yes. It's our pleasure. I'm wondering, I'm very interested in your idea about aesthetic truth and if you ever see things in real life that are almost too aesthetically truthful or too, that are just too perfect to be filmed. I'm thinking specifically of the brown bear coming back to Bavaria two summers ago, I think it was, the Bruno, mm-hmm. the bear. And it bookended Timothy Treadwell's story so perfectly, and I just wonder if that's... Do you have any thoughts about the problem there?
I heard about it and I read, but I was not in Bavaria at the time, and I think it is a human program to reintroduce brown bears into the European Alps. The Austrians have grabbed a few bear cubs and placed them into the mountains, and I believe Bruno, the bear, was also one of those bears that were part of a program. They reintroduced wolves into the lower Bavarian forest. They reintroduced lynxes, but it's a human activity to transplant them back into Germany or into Bavaria. It doesn't get Bavaria very far, and it doesn't get the bear very far. The bear was actually killed and shot by hunters because it did too much mischief, and so the population started to believe, yes, that was a bad idea, and you cannot introduce the grizzly bear into a park here in Philadelphia, even though it's the largest park I heard in any major city in the world. You better don't reintroduce a grizzly bear there. It doesn't belong there anymore. And in the coincidence of Bruno the bear in Bavaria and at basically the same time Timothy Treadwell finding his death is a statistical coincidence and has not really much has not much significance for me. It's a statistical sort of arabesque that happened out there. We should not forget also that Timothy Treadwell spent 13 seasons out there in Alaska with bears, with grizzly bears, and he had a quite a different program. He was a part of other things that led him out there, a part of other things. He, Treadwell, wanted to become a bear. He would go on all fours and huff and puff like a bear, and he would talk and sing to the bears. He wanted to adopt the existence of a bear. It's not exclusively what he did out there, but that was one of his major ideas, a part of protecting them. And yes, sometimes the craziest coincidences are happening, and yet there is no deeper truth in it. It's a statistical coincidence.
Thank you.
Yeah. But may I add something? Of course, sometimes there are things out there that are so truthful that you start wondering, can that have happened ever? It's so strange and so unexpected, and we are baffled by moments. And you are probably more alluding to those moments.
I think so.
Normally in our lives we do not experience it. We read about it in the newspaper. We hear about it through the media. And we are, unfortunately, as filmmakers, we are always too late to witness it.
Entschuldigung mit meinem Deutsch. Zum Wheel of Time. Wer ist wichtiger für die Humanität, der Künstler oder die Dalai Lama?
I did not understand your question.
Yeah. So I'll speak in Philadelphian English. In response to Wheel of Time, who is more important for humanity, the artist or the Dalai Lama?
Well, I would never make a comparison like that, or balancing who is more important, the goat or the apple. So I wouldn't know. But the artist and the Dalai Lama, each one has his role within the civilized world. Of course, the Dalai Lama has great importance as a religious leader and as a political leader and as a philosopher. I, in a meeting with the Dalai Lama, am nothing but a curious filmmaker. And that's about that. And strangely enough, we have moments where we are dancing together, even though we come from such different worlds. And I would never try to say who has more importance. None of them has much importance. When you look into the universe, and we are just a tiny, tiny speck of dust somewhere out there, we shouldn't put too much importance into our existences or into the existence of anyone out here. We are just trying to do our best. He does his best. I try to do my best. Of course, his role is more clearly defined, and he's the chosen one, and he's a reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. And for those who are into Buddhism and religion, of course, the significance of his existence is infinitely more superior than some filmmaker from Germany coming along and having a camera with him. So it depends on from where you see it, from which angle. But it wouldn't help the Dalai Lama, nor does it help me very far to know which existence has more importance. I don't care much about my existence anyway, so...
Thank you again for coming to West Philadelphia, really. You mentioned briefly the German Romanticist painter Caspar David Friedrich, and I was wondering if you could elaborate at all on what, if any, kinship you do believe might exist between the two of you as artists outside of the realm of aesthetics and whatever mm-hmm. compositional qualities have been compared in your works?
I have not really studied Caspar David Friedrich. I know literally nothing about his life. I do not know his biography. I've only seen some images. And they have given me some moments of great joy and almost illumination. But others have been much more influential, like Hercules Segers, early a Dutch painter, a printer, early Rembrandt time, who nobody took seriously. And he has made images that are hundreds of years ahead of his time. Only in the 20th century we have seen images that he has created. They are much closer. Hercules Segas is much, much closer to my heart than any other painter that I would know. And it's difficult for me to elaborate and to be theoretical about Caspar David Friedrich, but the way he puts a human being into a landscape has something extraordinary about it, something that resonates in me. And it's not a purely romantic attitude. It's something beyond romanticism. It has to do with a timeless sense of solitude that's within us, and not necessarily a notion of romantic culture. So probably reaching out far beyond that. Otherwise, I wouldn't know how to answer and how to draw parallels. I wouldn't know.
Thank you.
I've seen a number of your films, and you seem to draw inspiration from a lot of different things. And I was wondering what has been one of the most unexpected sources of inspiration for a work, something that you came upon in an unexpected way that might have delighted you.
Inspiration, I can't grapple this, I can't hold on to this term because I have no idea whether it ever occurs to me or what it actually is. I don't know. It's more like when I start a film, I always have the feeling of home invasion. I have not invited my films. I have never welcomed them, and yet they are there, and they push me, and they pressure me, and they disquiet me in such a way that I try to articulate them and try to get them out of the way. And of course, at the same time, I know that I can grapple with them because I can articulate. I can articulate stories. I can articulate concepts. I can articulate images. And some of these images that are commonly not seen yet, and I see them fairly clearly at the out there at the horizon, and a sense of duty. Yes, do it because you are the one who has to articulate it, who has to make it visible. I don't know whether that has to do with inspiration or not. It's a foreign. I feel foreign with a term like this. It probably does not occur to me.
And so when you have an idea, is there an unexpected source or that isn't necessarily inspiration?
Sometimes, yes, there is an unexpected source. Aguirre, The Wrath of God, I was at a friend's place and he was busy on the phone, and I looked through his books. He had lots of books. And I looked at a book about discoveries and adventures, Christopher Columbus, Magellan, others. And I opened the book and thumbed through it a little bit, and there's a short paragraph, 14 lines, about a man, Lope de Aguirre, in search of El Dorado, going down all the Amazon and calling himself the Wrath of God. And I walked out and started to write a screenplay. I immediately saw a whole film. I never did any research or anything. But here, in this very case, yes, I can name it, 14 lines in a book that immediately struck me. And it's not... It's not that I can say, yes, an inspiration. I only knew this is big. You gotta do it. Same thing, Timothy Treadwell. By coincidence, somebody shoves an article across the table to me and says, read this. And normally I just throw these things away. I somehow read it and jumped into the film and took it out of the hands of someone else who was supposed to do it. I really jumped into it from one minute to the next. And I started almost immediately. So there was, not that I can say inspiration, it was just something that stumbled into me, and I knew this boulder of rock is big, and you have to try yourself.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello, thanks again for coming here. Your energy and presence is most appreciated, as you know. I was wondering if you could speak more to the current, what might be called the current imagistic imperative. As anyone knows in this room, we're so completely flooded by so many images in the media, it's almost hard to make an image that's not in reference to an image which is, you know, reference to an image and so on and so forth, even if we were to, you know, move in a mud hut in the middle of the forest. So how, so can you speak to that imperative and furthermore how you as an artist sort of raw yourself up in a sense to try to get at the base of a real, true and viable image?
No, I'm not trying to rawing myself up. I am what I am, and but it doesn't occur to me that I see an image in reference to other images who are in reference to yet another segment of our popular culture or imagery that's out there. I'm much simpler in that way, and I'm someone who does not know irony, for example. I do understand humor, but I take things literal, and whatever other references that might be there doesn't occur to me. So for me, a chair is a chair. And I do not reference to other possibilities. What could the chair refer to in a very simple term? How straightforward and simple I see. For me, a man is a man. I cannot distinguish a gay man from a straight man. I just cannot distinguish, unless the man comes in drag. And is so obviously gay, then I would notice. And I saw a filmmaker whom I know since 35 years.
John Waters.
John Waters, just 2 weeks ago or so. John Waters. And I turned to my wife. We talked backstage because we were both introducing... was speaking at an event for the founder of New Line Cinema, who is a friend of both of us. After 35 years of knowing John Waters, I turned to my wife and I said to her, I have the feeling this man is gay. which is in a way wonderful, because I took him as John Waters. And I love the man. I love him dearly. And he's the boldest of the bold of filmmakers. I wish I had the guts of this man. And he's very, very dear to my heart. But for me, this is a man. Yes, a man is a man. And so I cannot see things with an overload of references to other strata of meaning and strata of cultural references. A little bit it sounds to me, this overload, like what is imposed in the post-structuralist thinking and post-modernist or whatever you name it. It's there that things get too complicated. I may misjudge this, but I cannot see images in reference to many other forms of previous images or parallel images, and yet I know very well at some moments what I'm seeing, what I'm witnessing is unique and never seen before. I stumble as a 14-year-old kid into 15 on a high plateau walking all the island of Crete in the interior. I stumble from a high pass, and there's this valley down below, and 10,000 windmills spinning. Not one building, 10,000, and it's literally 10,000 windmills. And what I witnessed there was something where I knew either I was insane, that there was something not right with me anymore, or it was something of such importance and so momentous that I had to preserve it, I had to make something out of it, I had to make a whole great story out of it, and I had to anchor a story. Coming across these windmills, I knew this was a solitary, never-to-be-experienced event in my life. So I can distinguish, yes, this is without references, I know that this was without references.
So in short, it might be the immediacy of experience which brings you to an image, period.
Not always. Sometimes it's an experience in literature. You come across a great poem and it just leaves you speechless and breathless, and you start to read it and reread it, and you become friend with a poet whom you do not know because he's 400 years dead already, and yet you are not alone anymore. The sense of not being alone anymore, that's very, very essential for me. Okay.
Hello, Werner. I have a special fondness for the two movies you made with Bruno S. and Kaspar Hauser and Strozek. And I just want to ask you if he is still alive and where he is. And
Bruno, I have not seen in many, many years.
Yeah.
But what I hear is doing fine. He's better than before because... I know that he stopped alcohol and smoking on one single day and just stopped it. And that has been a great, alcohol has been a all-pervading problem for him for a long, long time. He's a pensioner since more than 10 years. I think he worked as a forklift driver in a factory in Berlin. Financially, he's secure. He has a solid place where he lives. He has an environment that likes him and respects him, which was not there for a long time. And then some beautiful things. He released a CD with his street singing, with his ballads that he sings in the streets. He released a book with his aphorisms. And he had a gallery exhibition of his naive paintings. So
he played the accordion.
Pardon?
Right? He played the accordion, right?
You mean with his accordion?
Yeah,
or so
yeah.
The music,
yeah.
Yes, the music, it's a CD.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct. So I derive from that that he is stable and has a life that reaches far beyond the fact that he was for a few weeks in two movies.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to know how you feel your work has changed over the past, 30 or 40 years, either in terms of the subject matter that attracts you or your sense of the possibilities of the medium.
Well, it's not easy for me to look back and to evaluate myself, but of course, I always had the feeling I was moving on, and I'm not at a standstill and stepping on the same spot up and down and in tiny little squares and remaining there. I certainly have changed, and of course, I've grown older, and I have lived more life with my films. And have somehow in a way sometimes referred from one film to the next. It happens, yes. There's a clear nexus between many of my films, as if it was basically just one film. But I think it is not like that. There's totally new horizons out there. A film like Grizzly Man would not have occurred to me 20 years ago or 10 years ago. Or a film like The Wild Blue Yonder, or the film in Antarctica.
Can you explain why that would not have happened?
I don't know. I really do not know, but I always have had this curiosity in moving to new horizons and accepting a challenge that's out there. And yes, I do that. And I have, in a way, changed because I've been... into other work as well. I've staged operas, I've written books, I have acted in movies quite more frequently than in earlier times. And as we are standing here, there are two films out there that are just about to be released, one by Zach Penn, The Grand, and I'm the only one who doesn't have a name, I'm just the German. in a poker tournament, and I intimidate everyone else, and I travel with a huge load of cages with rabbits and hamsters, and so, and I explain that seriously to the Canon camera very quietly, that I need to kill something alive each on a daily basis in order to feel alive. And that I would eventually sometimes even bigger ones like a goat, but that's really an effort to strangle a goat. But unfortunately, the best moment of the speech that I made up myself is not in the film. What I said then, and it's cut out, I said I shouldn't really speak about killing because it sounds like something, a psycho, a butcher, or so. I'm not into that. It's a philosophical concept. It's very, very philosophical, and I should rather not speak about killing, but I terminate a rabbit today. And really fiendish, and I'm actually evicted from the poker tournament because they catch me cheating. So I do not see the end of the movie as an actor. And there's another film by Harmony Korine who is dear to my heart. Yes, thank you for the applause. Harmony did a film called Mr. Lonely, which is going to be shown fairly soon. I think at the London Film Festival was shown in Cannes. Mr. Lonely I have not seen yet, and it's a film where I'm playing a fanatical missionary priest. So, and it came easily to me.
You were great in it.
Who said that?
I saw it in Toronto.
You saw it, yeah.
I saw it in Cannes.
Yeah, and I saw...
You get those nuns to jump out of the plane?
Yes, yes, I think that's... and because I have psyched them up to such a degree and they are such firm believers... And when they pray in midair for redemption, you see them landing on the ground and walking away. And at the end, is this one scene in it, because I don't know whether Harmony kept it. At the end, a nun rides on her bicycle out of the rear end of the aeroplane, and she lands safely. Is that still in the film?
Yeah.
Good, yes,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. He had that image of the film when he was like 12 years old, and that's how the whole movie began, so
yeah.
He would have had to keep that.
Yeah, no, he's a wonderful filmmaker, and Julian Donkey Boy, but there I'm the epicenter of dysfunction, and I'm vile and base and hostile and dysfunctional, and of course I'm good at that. on camera I'm wonderful. I love myself as a father of a totally dysfunctional family. Yeah.
Hi, Werner. How would you compare Little Dieter Learns to Fly
Needs to Fly.
Rescue Dawn?
We shouldn't compare them. They complement each other.
Which one do you think tells the story better? Because they're both about the same subject.
Both tell the story in a very, very good way. I love both films, and they are quite different, even though the subject is the same. They really complement each other very well. I'm proud of both of them. I wouldn't like to miss any, and there's no such thing as a better or the other one. You don't ask your children, yeah, is this a better child here and that?
No.
I like them, and they are good. Yeah, please.
Just recently I was at the Cannes Film Festival, and like I was kind of struck by how like so much of it is like a marketplace, and like it's all about business, but then kind of at the same time, like there are these great films that are discovered there, and I was kind of wondering what your thoughts are and about like commercialization of like these independent films and how that works.
Yes, in a way I'm not one of those who is bashing the Cannes Film Festival. I'm not bashing the Academy Awards. I'm not into that business. Because the origin of cinema is a country fair, and it still has this kind of vulgarity and this kind of market and screaming out at the barkers out there at the market, and it has many of those things, many of those elements still alive, and those who are into cinema should not complain about this. I'm not into the culture of complaint. You have to accept it as it is, and in a way, not that I love it, but normally I love everything that has to do with cinema, including acting, writing, directing, producing, even the craze of Cannes Film Festival. Yes, it's very French and it's very artsy-fartsy and it's completely commercialized and it's a complete media circus. Yes, so be it. And I do accept it because I love cinema. Let's finish with that. I've talked a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you all of you for coming tonight. I have to ask that those people...